Oh, man. Man, oh, man. Are you guys ready for this? It's finally happening. We are finally here. The De La Soul, Juan Epstein, live from Atlanta for A3C. Before we get into it, I want to shout out our friends at Squarespace, squarespace.com. Shout out to my man Ant, who is currently building the new Juan Ep website. Now, Ant does like 9 million things, so he has very little time to work on our website. But that's what's amazing about Squarespace. It doesn't really take any time. It's so easy. And the version I saw of it that he's already done in like no time is beautiful. Literally beautiful. Okay? Super easy. So here's what I want you to do. If you support Juan Epstein, if you're excited about De La Soul, if you're excited about the fact that next week we have, I don't know, Stretch and Bobbito. Well, if you want to hear these episodes, support us. Go to squarespace.com, use the code JuanEp on Squarespace, and make the best website imaginable for the cheapest, for the easiest possible, lowest level of stress. Head over to Squarespace, okay? Blog, website, store, whatever you need. Squarespace.com, use the code JuanEp. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
All right, what's up, ladies and gentlemen?
Hello?
Nobody.
No.
Nobody has told us. This is before we start. Okay. Nobody told us if we're supposed to start yet or if somebody was introducing us. So we just decided to start. So we're starting. All right.
Yeah. Well, good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good evening.
And.
Good night. That's right. Well, honestly, you don't really have to know the show very well to figure that out. But I still appreciate it nonetheless.
Yeah.
How are you guys?
What's up?
Do any of you guys actually know the Juan Epstein podcast? Make some noise if you know Juan Epstein.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And who doesn't give a fuck? That girl? That guy?
Most of the people over there.
Nobody cares.
Do we sound okay? It sounds slightly distorted on stage. Anything we can do to make that better, because the millions and millions listening at home will want it to be high.
They're deaf rugs?
Yeah, these are deaf rugs. We need a Juan Epstein. Deaf rug.
Deaf rug?
You got that? Oh, we do.
A thing, a deaf rug?
Nick, are we working on the sound to make it stronger?
Check.
Is there anything we can do?
Deaf rug.
All right. Well, guys, thank you for being here. Are most of you guys, I guess, from Atlanta? Everyone here from Atlanta? No?
No.
Is anyone from Atlanta? Okay. Well,
okay. Atlanta.
I guess that's how ATLians make their noise.
You're from Atlanta? Anybody from New York? New York?
See, that's nice. How New York.
Nice. Nice. Long Island? Oh, L.A., sorry.
Oh, L.A.
No, because we have De La, so I thought Long Island. Sorry, I didn't see. You're right. L.A., I'm sorry.
Maryland? Maryland, that's right. That's where I'm from. Maryland, the house.
Maryland.
Yeah, we deep in here.
Okay.
All right, so guys, we don't want to waste a whole lot of time.
Okay.
For anyone who's not familiar, we do a
podcast. Juan Ep is a waste of time.
Yeah,
it just is a waste of time.
No, yeah, I know. And in fact, if you're even participating,
yeah.
You have time to waste.
Yeah, exactly.
But for anyone who's not familiar, we do a podcast called Juan Epstein. We've been doing it now for 7 or 8 years.
About 8 years, probably.
Yeah. It is the longest running and original first ever hip-hop podcast. We're very proud of it.
Least successful.
What do you say?
Least successful.
Least
monetarily
successful. Right. I realize we're like old school rappers now.
Yeah, exactly. Like we need a fund. We need a fund that you could contribute to us.
I think it's just people getting back at me. It's now like, yo, this white boy's gonna find out what it's like to have everything stolen. So now everyone's making millions off podcasts.
Right.
And me and Saif just moved into it together, which is really unfortunate.
But ours is pure and with great intentions.
It is. The intentions are great.
Yeah.
So anyways, if you've never heard it before and you're just here because our amazing guest today, we hope you go on iTunes and search for Juan Epstein and subscribe. It's free. It's fantastic. And we do it basically weekly now.
Yeah. Try to.
We just did an episode with OC, which is very cool. And
Consequence was good, talking about the tribe history.
Yeah, and I got a couple ones up my sleeve. We're about to do Buck Wild, which I'm very excited about.
Yep.
Anyone here know about Buck Wild? Make some noise if you know about Buck Wild. I just want to see where we're at. Okay. All right. I think they're ready. I think they're good.
Yeah.
So the special story for anyone who doesn't know behind this podcast that we're doing today is that about 5 years ago when Hip Hop Honors happened, De La Soul came by Hot 97, and we were very excited. They were promoting the Hip Hop Honors, and we did a podcast with them. And we did like 90 minutes, and we learned their entire history, and it was amazing.
Awesome.
Like, we were so giddy about it. And then it turns out it wasn't recording.
No, it was recording.
Oh, it turns out the recording was lost.
The CD, we recorded on CD back then. Remember those days, guys? CDs? So we had an engineer that didn't like to label shit and had just stacks of blank. Or will
so
look
you
like
think
blank
it's still
scenes.
Around potentially somewhere.
I mean, it's been thrown out since. I told you I have. I was just telling Pasta News. I have the second CD. It says Juan Ep De La on it. And when I pop it in, I was like, why is this the last 4 minutes of our
you
amazing...
should have just put that out. That would have been hot.
I have it.
We should just really, we should skip this and just
and I've gone
minutes.
Through every CD I own that wasn't labeled to see if I found part one. And we never found it.
So this is us making up for what has been known, if you're a Juan Ep fan, as the Lost De La episode. And they're so generous for doing this. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I think that they're not only one of the greatest music groups of all time. Mm-hmm. I think they are currently, to this day, still the best live performing music in hip group in hip-hop. I just think they're the best. If you have an opportunity to see them tonight, there's no better live performer.
Yep. Pioneers in making an album more than just music, having like a story to it and skits, you know?
They did so much. They're just, hey, let's not waste any time. Long Island Zone, they're one of the greatest of all time. All three members, De La Soul. Standing ovation.
Standing ovation. Well, I guess we should stand. De La.
Hold on, guys. We're going to do it again. We're going to do it again.
Shit. It's so awkward.
What are they doing, Nick? Were they taking pictures?
Okay, sit down.
Everyone sit down.
Shit. Because I want them to see y'all getting up. That really
Nick,
feels...
Nick, keep an eye on them and just see how far away they are so I can time it right.
Oh.
All right, hold on.
What's your favorite De La song?
Hold on. He's timing. Ready? Ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, here we go. De La Soul.
Nick, are you sure?
Ladies and gentlemen, De La Soul. De La.
There they are.
Yeah.
In the flesh. Look at
Mace.
Them. So agile.
True Gory. Yeah. You want to climb up? Oh.
We just had a conversation about tight pants, and there you go. It's very difficult to climb on things these days.
Posh, you could have used the stairs right there.
Oh, man. So we are still currently recording, engineer. Is that correct? Thank you very much. We're going to check in with him about every 15 minutes.
1, 2, 1, 2. Mic check, 1.
Mic check, 2, 2.
How are you guys doing?
1, 2.
We good, man. We're excited, actually.
Do you remember anything about, like, do you remember what we covered in the lost episode? Are we just going to, I don't remember. I think we can just start again.
No, I don't remember none of it.
Yeah, I can't recall.
I remember one thing, and I want to see if it comes up. And if it doesn't, I'll bring it up at the end.
That's it. You remember one thing.
One specific thing that no one else knows that we found out that day.
All right, so hopefully we'll reveal it again and people will actually hear what it is.
Yeah.
So listen, let's not waste any time. It's not often you have this opportunity to sit with a group as influential and amazing as you guys. So let's start from the very beginning. How did De La Soul get to meet each other, become friends, and start the beginning of this saga that is now up to 26, 7 years
old? You want like real beginning? Like...
Yeah, real beginning.
I mean, well, these two knew each other for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean...
I met them both in 85. Yeah. In summer school.
Yeah.
So you were all fucking up, basically.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. Me and Dave's brother was in the same grade, so when I moved from the Bronx to Long Island, we became really cool. Knew him from afar, like, oh, this is my friend Mike's brother. Years go by, we did summer school together, and that's how we kind of connected, and from there. So. Yeah.
And how heavy, will you guys make sure Paz's mic is up a little bit there?
1, 2.
He's a quiet
what
guy.
Part of the Bronx are you from, Paz?
The South Bronx.
Okay, nice.
The beautiful South Bronx.
Just making sure you don't have any of that Legionnaire's disease going around up there.
Sorry, too soon. And you're from the South Bronx also?
No,
you're from
not the South. Other parts.
Which parts?
The northern parts.
But also shitty.
Yeah.
Shitty, but not the
not
South.
South. Yeah, not that shitty.
And where were you guys in summer school that you met? This is now in...
Amityville.
In Amityville. Out in Amityville. So when did you go out there? When did you move out there?
Oh, Jesus Christ. When did I move there?
What grade?
I was fourth grade.
Oh, fourth grade.
Actually,
okay.
Third grade.
Third grade.
But I didn't start school until fourth grade there. I would, after my landlord tried to burn the building down in the Bronx.
Yeah.
I lived in Manhattan for a year while my parents got the house.
Oh, nice.
And then you got to move all the way out to Amityville.
Yeah.
So generally with the stories that we hear on this podcast, like 90% have like this glorious hip-hop story of the park down the street and plugging into the lamppost. And what was... Obviously, Long Island's a different world than New York City. So what was your guys' early introduction that made you actually start falling in love with the music being out in Long Island?
I mean, it was something that everybody was doing. I guess the influences came from the inner city, folks who probably was in the same situation, you know, bringing their kids to Long Island to, you know, have a better life or what have you. And those kids bringing that influence and that music and just that, I guess you could call it a... if you want to call it a hobby, a thing to do, to Long Island and begin to spread and grow. And just it being attractive to kids out there, it just grew there as well. And we weren't doing shows in the park or rhyming or anything like that. We was just doing it in the basement, you know, pretty much. We had basements at the crib. So it was basement parties and, you know.
Red light parties.
Yeah, all that stuff. So we would be basically at home, just working on music at home, writing things at home, playing records and, you know, doing pause tapes and stuff like that, and just.
So, what was your influence though musically? Because the interesting thing is, you guys came out. When you look back in history, you guys seem very advanced musically, lyrically, everything compared to a lot of the stuff that was like pre 85. Because you're basically, I mean, you're nearly contemporaries with the people who we consider pioneers, right? Like the Rakims and Kanes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You're only a couple years after that, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So who was influencing you guys musically as you guys are starting to kind of figure it out? And then also, how did you guys, what was the early dabblings in music? Who was rapping? Who was messing around with beats, et cetera?
I think early on, the influences were definitely what was to the left, you know? I mean, we loved everybody from... I mean, early on, from Cold Crush to Fantastic and all those groups. But I think when you started hearing or started paying attention to style and sound and all that, the people to the left more or less caught our attention, the Ultramagnetics, you know, KRS-One, you know, people who were really lyrical, people who approached it a different way. but we loved everybody from Granddaddy IU all the way up to, you know, LL Cool J, you know, so...
Was there more connection with EPMD or Rakim being from Long Island?
I wouldn't
say. That was coincidental.
Yeah.
It was,
I mean,
happening around the same time.
Yeah. I mean, we actually, even before Rakim was doing records, you know, with us knowing Biz, and Biz would always come up to our school, and, you know,
here we
Rakim,
go again with Biz.
Well, you know,
there's always a Biz
the
time.
The triangle of Biz.
Rakim was doing like a house parties or whatever. You would see him doing parties with Biz. So knowing this kid, it was he went by like the kid wizard Rakim. That's what he's going by.
I believe so.
Something like that. So
should have kept the kid wizard.
No,
I guess you're right. All right. Wait, well, hold on. Let's stop for a second though. How did you know Biz?
Biz used to come and just wherever he was going to school, skip class there and come to our school, hang out.
Yeah.
So
who skips school to go hang out at someone else's school?
Biz would just hang out at Amityville High School and terrorize the principal, actually.
Yeah. Biz used to do, he used to beatbox at a lot of parties around Long Island and a couple of skating rinks and stuff like
Biz
that.
Biz was actually around just promoting his shows.
He used to promote all his shows.
Yeah, by himself.
Like
just
what
going.
You see Biz do today, he always did back then. Yeah. He would come through with a flyer, he would beatbox, he would crack jokes, he would snap on you.
We had a mean principal, so he won the principal over to allow him to come to the school anytime he wants.
What kind of principal is this? They'll be like, how old was Biz at the time? Like 18, 19 years old?
Yeah, he might have been like 18.
Yeah.
But and he would just let him come hang out. And
he was scared of him.
Hang out, and he would bug out most of the day.
He was scared of Biz. Biz used to just hang out in the cafeteria all day.
Some people had like Pizza Fridays. But in Amityville, it'd have Biz Thursday.
Right? Yeah, but...
Yeah, it's Biz Thursday.
So wait, but you were saying you were drawing the connection between Biz and Rakim. So like, Rakim's also doing parties? Do you guys get to go do a house party and see Rakim perform?
I mean, when we were going to different house parties, we would see an early JVC force before they really got on. And, you know, of course, even like the coalition with Paul, like Prince Paul, of course, being in Stet when he got to be in Stet, even before Stet, Prince Paul was a very well-known DJ and very loved DJ.
Where's Prince Paul from?
Stetson Sonic.
No, I know that part. Where's he like actually from?
Amityville.
He's from Amityville too. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, that when Paul got on and just as Stet came out, you know, it just made you feel good. Like, wow, like someone from the neighborhood got on. It just puts that fire in your, you know, in your belly there.
It's kind of cool. Like around then, you'd see people at block parties or Wine Dance Day. You see Rakim get on the mic, or Amityville Day. You see folks get on the mic.
Oh, you see Groove Be Chill. Yeah. There was another one.
Cass would come out to Amityville a lot too. Grandmaster Cass.
Okay, and what are you guys doing at this point? Like musically, what are you trying to do, each of you?
These guys were in a different group at one point.
Uh-huh.
And Potts was a DJ, and he was a beatbox. Yeah. But they wrote for the cats.
Easy Street was the name of the group?
Easy Street, yeah.
That's tight. Yeah. Is that why you were just saying back in the room, you're like, man, I wish we just stayed at Easy Street and never right. included me in this.
Yeah, yeah.
But they always wrote for the dudes in the group.
Oh, you guys weren't the main MCs?
No, I was a DJ, Dave B-Box.
Yeah.
And but Pass, you know,
lift your mic up a little.
Like Dave B-Box, I was the DJ. You know, like routines was the big thing back then. So I mean, like how we can probably go through a lot of famous rap records where it was a routine and probably one person wrote it. So the MCs in the crew, they wrote, but we also helped write a lot of stuff too and come up with different routines.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we just, from there, was just...
From there, we didn't make it to the Apollo.
Nah.
So we
didn't have it. Easy Street wasn't it?
Nah. We was striving to get to the Apollo, but that never happened.
And oh, but that was like a big goal.
That was a goal.
Yeah.
That was a goal.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that didn't work out.
Yeah, it didn't work out. But, you know, we broke from that, and myself and Pos was just basically always writing. We always kept notebooks where we write ideas, you know, a theme to a song, a concept, rhyme styles, records that would match that. I mean, we had like just a notebook full of ideas, which eventually became what we presented to Tommy Boy, along with a couple of songs and them looking through and seeing our ideas. Like, you know, these guys really got something going on here. But before that,
your demo to Tommy Boy was a notebook.
It was a notebook of ideas and a cassette tape. Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're looking to get into the rap business and impress a label, right. Show up with a notebook, a little cassette.
But Mace was one of another popular DJ in the neighborhood, and we actually connected with a friend, Charlie Rock, who was a part of De La as well before it was called De La, and he brought Mason. Chuck didn't fit the whole vibe, and he wanted to do his own thing as well, so we was left with Mace.
Damn. We just left.
Yeah, we was left with Maceo, so it kind of worked out, and from that point, we just started, like, making songs and again, going through those concepts and creating ideas and stuff, you know, as a threesome. So
now we're getting to it coming together. What are some of those early original ideas that ended up on the demo? And also, how did you end up getting to go to labels and, like, you know, how did it all come together?
It was we had this routine. Plug tuning was a routine. It was just basically a routine, a rhyme we would do in a backyard party and what have you. found the 45, one of my father's 45, which was the invitations written on the wall. Zen, zen, zen. I paused it, played it for Dave, and I was like, yo, this could be the plug tuning routine. We can make a song to this. And he was like, yo, that's cool. Mace, he was working with, what's his name? The MC at the time? With
Gangsta B?
Gangsta B.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mace was in another group as well. He was moonlighting.
Like, him and Paul was working with this gentleman, Gangsta B, on this label from Everett Collins. He was he lived on my block, and he was the music teacher. He also
produced for Isley Brothers and Surface. And Surface.
Ooh. Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. What was his name?
Everett Collins.
Oh, yeah.
He was a percussionist and keyboard player for the Isley Brothers. Yeah. And he also produced, he co-produced that and Closer Than Close.
Nice. Yeah.
No disrespect, guys. What was what he just whistled for everyone who might not?
Happy? Only you.
Yeah.
There, I mean, that's the surface.
It's called black music. You don't know about that.
Oh. Was Drake on it?
Drake, yeah. All right. It could. Nowadays, it probably would be a Drake record.
All right. Okay, so your work doing that. Don't let us get off track.
Sorry.
And then let's keep going. How do we end up pulling this all together?
Well, here it is. This is around the time I moved to Long Island in 84. Between 84 and 85, I started meeting everybody, just meeting new friends. I've been playing sports, doing music. I met a lot of DJ cats, obviously. Friday and Saturday was big party nights for Long Island, especially with the football team. Mm. So I met a lot of DJs. That's where I met Chuck. And meeting Chuck is when I met Dave and Merce. And then it started to click from there. The following year, starting school fresh, we were in English class together. I think things started really to click for us late 86, early 87. Paul was just taking off with the Stet album. Every time he came to the neighborhood, he come home, he would DJ. Cats would be trying to record him. I think our relationship developed because I wasn't sweating Paul. I loved his work, you know. I loved him as a person, but everybody would be, Prince Paul going crazy, you know. And we just genuinely connected. And then for some time, I told him about the demos we were working on. And really, before Plug Tuning, it was like Three's a Magic Number.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
Ghetto Thing.
Ghetto Thing, yeah.
It was
De La Game, which became Daisy Age.
Daisy Age. Potholes on My Lawn was was early on. This is like speak. This was stuff that was brewing between 85 and 86.
Yeah. Wow. Before Prince Paul.
Yeah. With just us. Right. With just us. Yeah.
Yeah. This good is job, stuff guys. Good
we
job.
We was like four tracking and not even four tracking at this point. We were duping cassettes.
Yeah.
And all doing it together, like everyone kind of involved in the production and everything.
Yeah. Either I programmed the drums and Merce had the samples or Dave played the keys on it or something like that, you know. Everybody played a role, whether it was just recording it or
just being present.
So then how do you get the opportunity to go start actually shopping this to labels?
Well, as
Mason Paul.
Yeah, once he let Paul hear what we were working on, Paul loved it. I mean,
and he's already in a Tommy Boy.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess Paul obviously felt a connection to how we were putting together music.
I mean, try to make a long story short. Too late. You know, he was in a group. He was in a group where he couldn't really express the ideas he had.
Yeah.
He had some stuff that did land, but for what the style of Stet was, he couldn't really bring that diverse, quirky flavor we know him for, you know. So this day was just divine for both of us. He planned the stuff that he planned in Full Gear album, then he goes to play stuff that didn't make the album. And I was like, wow, then you really need to hear this stuff. And he was like, Mace, you've been saying this forever. Let's go get it. Yeah. I cut school for Prince Paul to go get these cassettes.
He was cutting school.
Because that day had a purpose. Yeah.
Nah, so I never really cut school, but this day I cut school for Paul. I wanted to go.
Stop lying.
So wait. So is any of that original music that didn't make in Full Gear stuff that made it to be De La Records?
Yeah. Do As De La Does was one of them.
I don't know.
Do As De La Does. The Mace Has Body. The Whisper record. I forgot that one.
Can you keep a secret?
That one.
And that's just a beat that didn't get used. You heard it, and that shit was dope. And then,
yeah.
So then you put together this notebook.
Treadwater was another one.
So then you put together this notebook and these songs. He gets you the meeting at Tommy Boy. Who do you guys meet with at Tommy Boy?
Well, we didn't meet. Basically, Paul and Daddy-O decided to shop demos together. Daddy-O had a group. Paul had a group. And so they decided to just put their two groups together, us and whoever, I guess, Daddy-O was shopping. They went to Profile.
Daddy-O had the Blind MC at that time.
Yeah. They went to Profile, First Priority Music, Warner Brothers Direct, someone else as well. Everyone wanted to sign De La.
Everyone wanted De La?
Everybody wanted De La.
Really? So everyone they went to was like, yes, we get it, we're in.
Yeah, they were in. So we could have went to any of those labels.
Wow. So why ultimately Tommy Boy?
I guess we just felt the comfort in Paul being there. He's kind of like becoming this person that we really respect. He's like a big brother. We know the history of Tommy Boy, of course. So I just think we all collectively just felt like...
It was just comfortable because Paul was there.
Yeah.
And we looked up to Paul and we kind of like, you know, allowed him to be the driver for the project.
And for him, it had to make the most sense. Like, let me keep all my shit together.
And pretty much, yeah. And we just felt cool going there. It just felt comfortable going.
I mean, I know everyone has mixed feelings on Tommy Boy, obviously, as the years have gone on.
Yeah.
But I will say it does, there is something about De La and Tommy Boy that, at least, I don't know, like from a, it's just a DJ label nerd standpoint, that goes, that there is something nice about it, well, even though I know there's some downside.
And underneath all of that, Tommy Boy was the place that we were supposed to be at. Trials, tribulation, whatever people think of them, they allowed us to be ourselves 100%.
Right.
Whoever came in and tried to direct us. And, of course, as a label, they, you know, they suggested things, you know, singles, we need that. But never told us, you can't do this, you can't say that.
So, right.
For us, it was perfect. I think we were meant to be there. And we wouldn't be sitting here if we weren't on Tommy Boy.
Yeah.
So
we could have been on Black Watch. La Mamba wanted us, and we could have went that rate.
The what? We could have actually been with Black Watch at one point. With La Mamba Carson.
And what's the name
Paradise.
Of the What's the name of the group, though?
X-Clan.
Oh, well, yeah, and that they didn't have a lot. There wasn't a lot. Over there, right?
That was a good record, but it wasn't my
favorite. Well, no, X-Clan was great, but they didn't have other stuff besides. Although, let's be honest, I mean, marketing X-Clan was also probably an interesting challenge.
Yeah.
In retrospect. Shout out to X-Clan. What a great group. But anyways, so you guys, how fast do things start moving then? When you get the green light, you have some songs ready. How did things go?
Plug tuning, we thought that was the beginning and the end, tell you the truth.
Yeah, we was just looking to hear it on the radio and...
And that was kind of that. They were off to college. I was getting ready to go to the military. Then the opportunity came back to do Pottos on my lawn. Mm-hmm. And then after that.
So at first it was looking just like a single? Like that was the only thing that was happening?
Yeah, it was single deals then. It was like a test run.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think it was definitely a test run in everybody's mind. But at the same time, we did sign for a contract to do an album.
After the second single.
Okay, so it's just not a guarantee you're going to get to that place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who played it first? Who played on the radio first?
P-Fine.
Yeah, P-Fine played it first.
Yeah, P-Fine played it right.
What station?
I forgot the college station.
God, I respect you guys remembering the first play.
Yeah, P-Fine, definitely.
Because I thought, of course, I'm thinking you're going to say Red Alert or Marley.
Was P-Fine BAU?
I forgot. It was...
No.
I forget what it was.
Not BLI.
It was.
I forgot what station it was.
I truly forgot.
Yeah, but P-Fine was the first.
A college radio station.
College radio station, yeah.
And then the second was Dr. Dre from Ed Lover, Dr. Dre.
Yeah, BAU.
That was BAU.
BAU.
Operating room.
Yeah.
And then it was like Jeff Foss after that. It got the red a little late. It got the red like a little later.
Did it get, by the time it got to red, did it feel like a frenzy? Could you feel that there was true momentum?
I mean, it's just like as May saying, to have Red DJ over, you know, cut it up, to hear Mr. Magic say world premiere and then your music play.
Yeah.
That was a big thing for us.
Yeah.
But then after that.
To hear like someone from the label was like, yo, they're playing it in Texas. Wait a minute, yo, they're playing it in LA. Y'all got to go to this roller skating rink and perform at whatever the name of that place was. That was our first performance out there. Like, so it really took off. I mean, and mind you, here it is when the album was coming together, you know, our first performance we do at a Stetsasonic release party, and Russell comes up to us like, yo, I'm on your dick. Like, I want to sign y'all.
Direct quote?
Direct quote.
Direct quote.
I figured you wouldn't have said that unless it was a direct quote.
You don't even want to see the hand movements he did.
Yo, I mean, shout out to Russell. We know Russell.
Russell back in the day was pretty extra, you know.
Oh, he's all pretty
zen,
extra.
He's all like, zenned out now, you know what I mean? But
oh no, all you got to do is put a microphone. He's
but
still.
Like, we're like, you know, we young kids. Like, yo, this is Russell Simmons, and DMC's at the front of the stage. Is like,
wow,
do it again, do it, perform again. So it was great.
What were you performing? Just
plug tuning.
Plug tuning.
Yeah.
That's it.
Shit, that's dope.
So we were signed to Rush immediately. Like, we was on Rush Management.
Oh, Management,
You know.
All right, so now you're signed to Rush Management. The label's probably geek because Plug Tunin's actually doing its thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, all right, what do you have next?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
What's next? And we were straight into the studio recording an album. But we had so much, so many notes and so many ideas that it was actually easy rolling into doing an album. Mm. It almost was like stop. I guess that's why we ended up with like 27, 28 songs. But the ideas were there, the records were there, and we were just recording them at that point.
In the Long Island, or were you
now
in the city?
Calliope Studios at this point.
What studio?
Calliope. That's where Stet recorded, Biz recorded.
Everybody.
Is anybody like, now that you're starting to get a little success, you're recording an album, is anybody popping up? Where's Q-Tip popping up, or any of these people?
Yeah, they didn't come around until in recording that album, we had a show in Boston somewhere, I think us in Jungle. And that's how we kind of connected with them finally.
Right.
You know.
So that's how the Jungle Brothers thing started, was just at a show?
Yeah,
just
we did Boston, a gig in Boston, a day gig in Boston, doing a show. Saw Jungle a week before.
At Latin Quarters.
Latin Quarters. And it was like, yeah, we got this gig coming up. That's when Jimbrowski was huge. And
straight out the Jungle just dropped. Yeah. The album just dropped.
We did the gig in Boston, and we was like, yo, we got this song that like kind of like it's a – almost like a parallel to Jimmy. We got this song called Jenny. And they was like, oh, that's dope. Let's hook up over the weekend. We got a show in Queens. And then we hung out with them in the show in Queens. And then from that point, invited them to a studio session that we had possibly maybe a couple of weeks later. They came and hung out in the studio. We met Q-Tip at that show in the park.
Q-Tip and Ali.
Q-Tip and everybody and them came to the session that we had a couple of weeks later, and we recorded Buddy.
Yeah, it wasn't even planned for them to be on Buddy.
Yeah.
They would have came a day earlier, a day later. They could have been.
Oh, Buddy wasn't going to be a posse cut.
No, it was just they came to the studio.
So that day he was playing that, so then they got on that.
We was working on.
We was working on that.
Yo, you want to jump on this? And they just
rhyme on this.
Yeah.
Ooh, I want to say it was a lot. A lot of people were involved in that record. I think.
Yeah, I was about to say, how did everyone else? Because other people, like, how did Moni Love? Like, how did everyone get involved in that?
And I want to. I don't recall if Moni was there for the original version.
Nah, the remix.
She was
the remix. Her and Latifah. Right.
Yeah. Okay,
like,
so you added them.
Considered the standard or original version of Buddy is obviously the remix.
Now is the remix. So what ends up being the second single after Plug Tune? Is it Potholes?
Potholes, yeah. Potholes.
Which, by the way, in retrospect, what a weird fucking song. You know? Like, I remember as a kid, it seemed totally normal. Like, I love this song. But like, when you think about it in the landscape of hip-hop, it's a pretty random, weird, which I guess totally sums up perfectly the role that you guys played in general.
Right. I mean, that's who we are as people.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like... It was perfect for us. I mean, we didn't even see it. We never roll into these songs thinking of doing something different or being, you know, different or...
Yeah, avant-garde or some shit. You're just doing...
It's just we doing it, you know, and it makes sense to us. It sounds good. It sounds cool. And sometimes as stupid as it may sound, it sounds like art to us, you know what I'm saying? So we just do it for just doing it. And a song like Potholes in My Lawn was trying to make sense of the... Well, having a concept, but not wanting to spell it out, you know? So here we go. We want to do a song called Sucker MCs Bite My Rhyme, but let's call it Potholes in My Lawn. And I mean, when that came out, that was another one. It was just like, okay, I think I was on the Long Island Railroad when I heard that the first time, like on a little Walkman radio thing. And those things just happened. We was taking it all with a grain of salt. Like, you know, I don't think we ever thought being, you know, obviously any sort of like rap, you know, stars or anything like that. It was just like we was doing our music, and fortunately it was being played. You know,
so. We thought we were stars. We thought we were stars in terms of, as you said earlier, we had succeeded because we just heard it on the radio.
That was enough.
That was it.
Yeah. That was enough. I mean, the first time we was like, I think the first gig we might have had out of New York was Texas, and you would have thought we went to Mars. You know,
like, oh, and the show was with the Ghetto Boys
and
Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Yeah.
Yo, 80s rap is the best. Like
the
what,
best, bro.
The bills you yo, look at. Yo,
the best time in my life, look, man. I can't even lie.
You got to figure, in 89, the first tour we went on, LL, Slick Rick, Us, P.E., Ghetto Boys, N.W.A., Too Short.
What?
Special Ed.
Special Ed.
Special Ed.
We was all on the same
J.J. Fad.
Like all that stuff in the movie of N.W.A., that tour was the Nitro tour. We was on that tour. We was all on that tour.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. How much were tickets for that show? No, like, what, 20
I mean,
bucks?
Back then, it had been like 10, 15 maybe. Tickets weren't a lot back then.
Yeah. And that was another thing.
Tickets weren't a lot.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Recording 3 Feet High and Rising and the success of that, you know, we went straight on that tour. Like, you know, newbies, like, we was doing gigs and stuff like that. But a tour, like.
Yeah, that's crazy.
On a tour with LL, Cool J.
Kane.
Yeah. Slick Rick. EPMD was on some of the gigs.
Lot fell off that tree.
What?
Whole lot fell off those trees.
No, I mean, to be thrown into that situation, not only overwhelmed because of the workload and the expectation as now artists, professional artists, but the overload of, wow, I'm around, you know, people who I've been looking up to for the last, you know, 10 years.
Yeah.
To be in the same room and in the presence of LL or LL watching our show or, you know, and what was cool, what I loved about back then was, you know, people would sit you down.
Yeah.
And even if it was a minute, you know, Chuck would be like, yo, make sure you, you know, Russell or DMC would be like, I remember Russell saying, yo, don't be afraid of going out there. If you ever feel anything, you know what they, you know what running them do? They look over their heads. They don't look in their eyes. Just look over their heads. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of nice back then, even coming up, that we were being schooled. You know, yeah. We were being taught along the way by these people who we, you know, looked up to. You know, yeah. That's something that I think was really good for who we are today. Just being able to give as well. You know, as much as we can.
And what an interesting way to start performing. Because like I said, I don't know if you guys heard it. It was during the first time I introduced you guys, but then you weren't there. But the first time I said the greatest, I think still you guys are the greatest performing group in hip-hop.
We like, sucked in the beginning.
I was going to ask.
What?
So where do you start when you jump? Because we in our world, you know what I'm saying? Like I remember like a year ago, whatever, at Fool's Gold, McConan had that Tuesday record. It had been out for like a month. Mm-hmm. And A-Track, you know, he always pulls out great shit at Fool's Gold. So they had him show up. Mm-hmm. And this kid walked on stage. And when I tell you, it looked like he hadn't even performed in front of his fucking mirror yet. Oh. And that's not a diss. He was brand fucking new.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I was like, so anytime an artist gets thrown in front of a huge crowd and doesn't know yet, I mean, you guys, that must have been fucking tough early on.
It was. I mean, especially to have an album so visual. We were still trying to figure out how to physically show that to the crowd. You know? So that it was tough at first.
Those arenas are huge, too. Commanding that stage is tough. Yeah.
It is. And in addition to that, we were fortunate enough and have the guidance of a Russell Simmons and a Lior Cohen to just also move us outside of that traditional hip-hop setting and get us on tour with Fine Young Cannibals or who else? I'm not too sure.
You went on tour with
Lenny Kravitz, Sinead
O'Connor. Right after Nitro tour, Fine Young Cannibals.
Fine Young Cannibals. So even getting in front of...
Oh, my God. My dad could have seen you on tour. That would have been amazing.
Even getting in front of those audiences and them definitely not knowing who the hell we were, that was even a bigger challenge. I mean,
arenas also?
Yeah. Arenas and festivals.
And amphitheaters.
Yeah.
You had to win them over on stage, like right there. Like, they didn't know your songs.
Yeah.
That was tough. That was another Russell Simmons moment. Because I personally couldn't do it. I just for me, the fright of being up there and trying to prove to these people who probably didn't even know what hip-hop was a little too much, and I think we actually canceled that tour.
Well, you wanted to leave. You wanted to get off the tour, and Russell got on his leave.
Russell did another thing. Come on, man. Come on, B. I'm telling you. Suck y'all dick, man. Come on.
I was about to say, more sus random shit from Russell. There's a theme here. And he was like, please.
I didn't think he was going to say it.
That's love. We love Russell. But he was that classic character that, you know, he would just come
in. He wasn't in the yoga yet.
Save the day.
Right.
It was no yoga.
This is
pre-yoga, Russell.
They're talking about a Def Jam movie, right? And shit like that is what needs to be in there if you're going to show the Russell character.
Russell was the – and it was that was important, too. I mean, I love those dudes so much because – they came out, and they in the early days, they were always in the trenches. They'd come out to the show, support us, be there, waiting for us to get off stage, congratulate us, tell us where we could do things better, mm-hmm. tell us when the tough times were coming. You know, they was amazing for us, and it was kind of good that, you know, we were willing to be students. I mean,
the game. Russell Simmons is definitely like the Don King of hip hop, straight up.
Mm-hmm. In a good way.
Minus the like ripping off Mike Tyson part.
In a very good way, because I mean he's done really great stuff. Like, come on, he set LL Cool J up. You know what I'm saying? Like, especially the artist that was with him in the trenches. You know, like he brought the business to everybody's talent. You know, I think a big formula of what we still do today come from Russell and Lior.
Yeah,
you know?
Lior as well. You know, yeah. We have to echo the same with Lior. Lior has just been amazing. Even to this day, you know, just seeing him is really good. But Lior, I mean, you don't have that. And I remember, and I know you both remember it. I remember the day where it was Tribe about to release their album. And, you know, things happen. You know, you kind of like shift. De La's in, Tribe's in, and so many others. And Lior was frank with us. He was like, yo, man, tough times are coming. Be careful. Like,
tighten up your belt.
Yeah, we had just released Balloon Mind State.
And they were aware that things were shifting. You know, they were aware.
Oh, wow. So this is in like 93-ish. And he was basically saying, Tribe's about to go on their shit.
Pretty much. Yeah.
You guys might have a tough spot
right now. Yeah. Well, here come Wu-Tang. Here come Biggie.
So, you know, this
album, you know. And I mean, I'm sorry to cut you, but... And even talking about albums, Balloon Mind State had always been one of those albums where even to this day, people will be like, you know what, when that came out, it was like one of your albums that I didn't really get into then, but now that I'm older, I appreciate it.
See, that makes me feel like a bad De La fan, because I'm in the age range when Balloon Mind State came out is when I was buying albums on my own. Mm-hmm. So that's always been almost my favorite one, because that was my album. Yeah. And it's not like it wasn't strong all the way through. It was complete. Mm-hmm. Someone tweeted me this morning, or on my Instagram when I posted the flyer, and was like, Break of Dawn is the reason I'm into hip-hop to this day. Mm-hmm. And we'll get to Balloon Mind State. Also, I just want to say, you guys were opening up like first for Fine Young Cannibals. You come on first.
Yeah.
And then who else was on this tour? This is the funniest thing to me I've ever heard in my life.
And then Fine Young Cannibals.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll look who ended up winning the big one. See Fine Young Cannibals? Where the fuck are you guys at? They're fucking legends. You guys don't even know who Fine Young Cannibals is.
I mean, we did it all. We did an opening gig for Tito Puente. We did...
What?
We played on festivals. I mean, we were performing prior to them, but we played on festivals with Wendy and Lisa, Lenny Kravitz.
Sinead O'Connor.
Yeah, Sinead O'Connor. Yeah. I mean, so we were out there. We were like, you know, we were doing other things.
But I wonder in the long run, because what I was going to say was, so my best friend my whole life, Ben Pleasure, was always into De La. His older sister, who was, you know, maybe a little older than my brother, but like a super white, hippie-ish girl, mm-hmm. like was super into De La. Mm-hmm. So there was something, I was going to say, like, is it something about your sensibility? Because Tribe generally gets the credit, rightfully so, for being like really crossing over in a huge way and bringing tons of white fans, passionate, not just... There are already random white fans who liked shitty stuff, mm-hmm. but bringing passionate white fans who loved good hip-hop in. But you guys actually really did that first with the mm-hmm. 3 Feet High album, and I wonder, is it because of your sensibilities and being from Long Island that there was something that people connected to, or is it also a mix of the interesting ways that they put you guys out there and put you in front of people?
I think it's a combination.
Yeah, combination. Yeah. Definitely a combination.
I think when it comes to the actual, you know, music, obviously we try to go beyond just the, you know, typical 1-2-1-2. So I think it connects with a vast array of audiences.
And you can relate. This is going to sound weird, but you could go on those tours and relate to those kind of people, because growing up in Long Island, there's a mixture of people.
Absolutely.
And as opposed to somebody from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, that will be around Fine Young Cannibal fans and be like, these fucking white motherfuckers is crazy.
That's real. No, that's real. And not only were we, like, you know, crossing color lines, I mean, when we did gigs, you'd see 17-year-olds all the way up to 55-year-olds at our shows. You know, so.
And I wonder if that's also the choice of music you guys sampled always, too.
Yeah, as well.
That definitely played a part.
Now,
sampling played a significant part back then. Here it is, there was a lot of MCs that weren't that great. It was just based on what they used.
Yeah.
Made them kind of hot, right. You know, and how the song structure was formatted and the quality of the mix.
All right, as we continue on, I hope you're enjoying this so far. We still have lots, lots more with De La Soul live from A3C in Atlanta. Next week, Stretch and Bobbito also. And the reason we're able to do all of this stuff is because of our friends at Squarespace.com. So if you want to make your own website, if you want to start your own blog, if you want to start your own podcast, if you want a store, if you want to make a dedicated website to Juan Epstein, please feel free. Just do it at Squarespace.com. Squarespace.com, head over there, use the code JuanEp. When you type in JuanEp, not only will they give you a great deal, but you'll be supporting the podcast. So if for any reason you've been considering building a website, I'm not just saying this, this is a facto. There's no easier and more affordable way to do it than Squarespace.com. So Squarespace.com, use the code JuanEp. That's JuanEp, JuanEp. All right? Get the hookup from them and support the podcast. Juan Epstein and Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You mentioned NWA briefly. On that tour, do you guys ever all party together or did people just... Some of those scenes like in the movie, right? Yeah.
We have when there was no surveillance, when there was no key cards to hotels and all of that. Yeah, and
we've done some naughty shit that went down.
Yeah.
And there would be parties where everyone would be down. It wouldn't be like people would all go into their own.
Man, listen,
we're here to listen,
man.
So you tell us.
You know, man.
It goes beyond parties. What was cool is that.
Ladies, can y'all step out for a minute? We're going to have a talk, right?
I mean, it was.
Man.
It was Let's just say Kane would mention the hotel every night.
Mrs. C told us that.
Every night.
So he the lobby operator would be the song we all waited for.
He would call me, like tell girls, like, yo, this is my little brother. Like, could I have my little nappy flat top?
Oh, yeah, you're the Stockton, yeah.
And so he'd be like, oh, this is my little brother. He's like, oh, and the girls be like, oh, you're Kane's brother. And I'm
like, yeah. Meanwhile, little daddy Shane is like, fuck you, Pasta News.
Oh, we watched Shane really become a man on that tour.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I guess that's what that was one of the things too as well. People just
went. Oh, if we're getting Too Short was on that tour.
Well, yeah.
Too Short.
Fuck fest.
I mean, like I guess, and I don't know if Dave was trying to get to that.
When they all came around, people was like, "Oh, okay, peaceful day." But you know, through the night, they kind of like saw a different face.
Okay, but yeah, I was gonna say, love, but that is something that clearly impacted you guys. The whole flowers, hippies, oh, De La's so nice. De La Soul is Dead was obviously a big response to that.
Yeah.
And that's how people saw it.
Yeah.
So you guys did get frustrated with the image that got cultivated?
I think we were frustrated with the direction of the label in which they felt that they had to promote the product and suggest
it was
what the group was about.
It was a concept you had for an album. They made it. Like, that is De La Soul.
They made it a lifestyle and an image.
Right.
So Peace Porridge from De La Soul is Dead is really, like, kind of some of the...
An ode to, yeah.
Yeah.
Rebelling from that.
We find ourselves getting into, you know, due to someone may feel a certain way or thought that...
I mean, when we were on tour, we was the fighters all day.
Yeah, we've heard.
Thank you. Thank you for taking us there, because we covered this in the first one, I remember. Yeah, how did that reputation come to be? Because for those of you who don't know, within the hip-hop business... It's like, oh, De La, nicest guys ever. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's true. But they will punch you in the fucking face if they have to.
I mean,
how did that reputation come to be?
Tour. That's it. I mean, I remember. Damn, Mace. Remember.
You already told it to us once, and it didn't get recorded. So you got to tell us again.
There's some story you told us.
I'm
not too sure if it was the day we signed with Tommy Boy. Me, Mace, Merce. We call him Merce. His last name is Mercer, so we call him Merce. But me, Mace, Merce, and Paul walking back, trying to catch the train. I think me and Mace getting a fight.
Microphone.
We saw some cats that was already fighting, and it just happened
to be. I don't know how we got in it.
I laughed, and the dude got mad and spit in my face, it went from there.
Oh, you laughed at the fight?
Wait, on your way to the Long Island Railroad?
Yeah.
From signing your record deal.
And Paul was like, damn. I thought it was my piece. Y'all thought y'all was my piece.
You think wrong.
We got kicked off the LL tour.
Yeah, we got kicked off the LL.
Yeah. Fighting?
Yeah. We're fighting, yeah.
Yeah.
But so were people just trying to test you guys?
No, we was just...
It wasn't always that, because it would just be like, say, if Kane had, or Scoob and Scrap, Kane's dancers had a problem, I guess people would jump in.
We had
in.
Each other's back on the tour.
Yeah, we, but they was all, it was always De La come through. Like, it was like...
Yeah, but why, that's what I'm saying. Why you guys, though? Like, weren't there times you'd be like, yeah, y'all work that out? You guys seemed like you were ready to scrap.
I think we're just loyal people. And I think coming from, like, I'll sort of attribute it to Long Island. Like, coming from that kind of a neighborhood where you make an alliance with people, and it doesn't matter who you are, you know, white, black, orange, purple, male, female. I think when we make alliances with people, we have a loyalty there. And being on that tour and looking up to some folks, as well as, you know, sharing day in, day out for almost 2 months straight, we felt like, you know, we're family, and we would do whatever we could for anybody out there. So, you know, we were, I guess, maybe possibly the three people who felt like that the most, because we was in most of the nonsense.
Well, and also, yeah, and you guys are younger, and you really looked up to these people.
It was like, that fried chicken, Mace. It was that fried chicken.
Yeah, it started with the fried chicken.
Started with the fried chicken.
What do you mean it started with the fried chicken?
Our rider had fried chicken on it.
Good.
This is grilled!
Right. But we got tired of it, and we almost felt like, you know, they were taking us for the being the newbies on the road, and they could just do anything for us and feed us anything. It started off with a nice tray of, you know, biscuits, and then by the middle of the tour, it was one bucket of chicken, like, you know. So we started flipping tables over,
we flipped the table over every day.
Now, Sife, wasn't there a story on the original Lost episode about a show that you knew about involving them where something happened on stage?
The Tretch?
Perhaps.
At the Palladium?
Oh, the Palladium.
Oh, the Palladium show.
Yeah.
That was a night. That was Stakes Is High album release. That's the night I met Mos Def for the first time.
Thank you.
We did a show at NYU, and then right from there we went to the Palladium. And that was all around. Yeah. We did some at NYU first, and then we went to the Palladium.
Okay. And then what happened? What happened? What's the story at the Palladium?
Tretch thought you dissed him in a record.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was that confusion about?
The intro to Stakes Is High was originally a remix to Eye Patch. That's why it starts off with the same rhyme. Channeling, NSYNC, Someone What Bring. And I guess towards the end of that remix, I say, stick to your naughty by nature and your cane, because the rhymes that I post upon you, something makes you feel insane. So I was just trying to say, stick to your way of nature and your cope, because my rhymes are more potent than that. So I put their rhymes in it. And that was actually like from the Balloon Mind State album, like I said, a remix that just never came out. It just come around to making Stakes Is High, the end of Stakes Is High. We chose to try to find an intro, and we came back to that and put that at the top of it. And I guess by the time...
And I won't lie, though. It sounds like a diss. Like, it sounds like you could take that as a diss.
I mean...
Not if you're a De La fan.
Probably around those times, because when I think back constantly, even around that time, those was real.
Is his mic on? His mic sounds not on.
One, two.
Those was real sensitive.
Is it recording?
Is Dave's mic on? Is Mace's mic on?
Okay.
One, two, check. One, one, two.
All right,
check.
A little better.
One, and you don't stop. Keep on.
So you were saying, Mace, around that time?
Around that time, times was real sensitive. So here it is, dudes with. Take metaphors and think it was subliminals.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, subliminal was a big word.
Still is.
Yeah,
still is.
So, and that's a time where everybody was really being super sensitive about the diss records. Pac was at his peak with dissing everybody at this point. And also, groups was having internal issues. So if you got an internal problem, definitely across the way, you feel like you got an issue over there.
Oh, and you guys are also label mates.
Yeah,
you and Naughty. So what happened at the Palladium? So he approached you?
Well, no, I mean, at first it was
marching
like,
through the crowd. Remember that?
You saw
I'm in the DJ booth, so I'm looking. The DJ booth was on the second level, so I'm looking down. De La's on stage.
But his peoples was already at the front of the
stage. Yeah, they was already in the front.
So we're performing, and one of his peoples just reaches his hand out like a normal fan, like, oh, shit, and I go to give the dude five. Next thing I know, they're trying to pull me in the crowd. I'm like, yo, why is this dude holding my hand? And then Let go of my hand. And I look, and then Tretch is coming close. I was like, oh, shit. And like,
my hand.
When I watched Tretch walk in, and it was like, dum, 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 da, dum, dum, dum. And he's like weaving through the crowd. I'm like, oh, Tretch is coming to watch this. Oh, no, oh. Tretch is not coming to watch.
So then what ended up happening? Was there a brawl?
No, nah, nah. They tried to pull me off stage. They didn't. And then all our peoples jumped on stage and all that shit. But nothing fortunately happened.
And you guys eventually talk and explain that?
Yeah, I mean, months and months go by. Because even before
no,
that,
don't skip the mace on the mic. Be like, oh, we ain't no pussy-ass Long Island niggas who fuck anybody up.
And then why are you saying
thank
that?
Thank you,
like,
Saif. Thank you for not forgetting that.
Why are you saying that? Like, 300 motherfuckers is jumping on stage for us. It was crazy. That was crazy.
I mean, later on down the line, we spoke with Tretch.
Yeah.
I mean, Tretch has always been family since day one. I mean,
that's still my brother, for real.
Yeah.
We were the first, actually, Tretch's first show, first performance ever. We actually
put
them on stage to perform.
North Carolina.
OPP? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I think he actually went into it like, yo, I was bugging. Well, you know,
when that happened, he let us understand that, like, I had to come there. Like, I had to do that because I felt like he said if he didn't even come there, they would have even took it further than that.
Right.
So, you know, but.
That makes sense. So it was, like, the best way to just do something.
Yeah. So we had to just fuck you up opposed to shoot you.
Right. Yeah. Of course. That's much better. all things considered. The rap game has changed, guy. So 3 feet high. Big deal. De La Soul is dead. How was the reception for De La Soul is dead? And were people thrown off by you guys going a different direction?
I think definitely. I mean, I know the label was pissed, but again, like they gave us our freedom, you know, and they rode with us and believed in the project in the end. But people were definitely thrown off and didn't get it. For the most part, Europe loved it.
Yeah.
So that's when that started to shift a little bit.
I think hip-hop fans.
Yeah, that's my favorite Dilla album.
Yeah, I think hip-hop loved it.
But like the wider audience, not whiter.
Not whiter, wider.
Wider.
And I think that's when the shift started to take place as well, going to Europe more often, Japan, around the world. And I mean, it was a well-received record, but it definitely was tough times for us. I mean,
you guys continued for years and years after that. Up until when I saw you do this in, like, the mid-2000s, I feel like, when you perform Me, Myself, and I, say, we hate this song, but you love this song. We hate this song, but you love this song. Mm-hmm. Why do you hate that song? Do you still hate that song?
I mean, we love the song. And I think we've even had a conversation about this maybe a couple of years back. We kind of want to stop saying that because originally, I mean, it's a Parliament Funkadelic record that we love. But it's the idea of that's the only song that people connect, you know, De La to. And we have a lot of, you know, music and obviously a long list of music.
And it was the radio record the label anticipated coming from us.
You didn't hate the song. You're just sick of performing it.
Yeah.
And we try.
Because even if you go somewhere to do a promo show and you're going to do two songs, that has to be one of them.
Right. And we try to get it. We try to remove it from the set list, but you can't do that. You know, you can't do
I think good song, the way we perform it now, it's a little bit more close to the Parliament Funkadelic version than our version.
I mean, I'll be honest. I'm sorry. No Russell Simmons. I'm not trying to say suck your dick here, but you guys could perform anything any fucking way you want to perform it. Like, there's something about the way you guys perform these days. Like, I did a bunch of Rock the Bell shows that you guys were on. Like, every time it was just the best shit ever. There's something.
Thank you.
The whole freezing shit you did with the Doom song. You just did a whole bunch of shit that's crazy. God, there's a lot of stuff to get to still. Okay.
Native tongues, man.
Yeah. So Consequence came on the podcast a few weeks ago, and we got into a long conversation about the way Native tongues chose to claim or not claim each other, right? Like, these days, there's no questions about who Young Money is, right? Like, my wife knows who is in Young Money. It's all, they're on every song together. You know, it's all put together. Mm-hmm. Native tongues, it was almost, I won't say it was a secret, but you guys didn't like, it wasn't completely blatant at all times. You popped up in random little pieces. Mm-hmm. How did the Native tongues relationship build, and what was kind of the logic about how Native tongues moved, or was there no logic?
I think that was attributed to it not being an agenda. Bruce, right. I'm coming in the studio. Where y'all at? That's all it was.
Yeah, friends just hanging out. Yeah.
So it was like, okay, yo, say this. Y'all need somebody to do this chorus. You know, anything. Like, you hear, like, people whispering or...
Yeah, I got Jarobi, the rhythm.
I'm sorry, Jarobi doing the Kermit the Frog voice on Peace Porridge. I could do Kermit. You know what I'm saying? So it was just hanging out, and then
it was definitely about making everybody better. I think it was more studio based than anything too, because everybody did lend ideas to one another to make each other just better.
Yeah,
I mean it was definitely cool when I look back on it now, and you can see Chris Lighty, you know, rest in peace. You know, them thinking from a business standpoint of how we should take better control of the name and making it to something. But as we're saying, we just saw each other as just friends hanging out. I mean, as much as we can say even Tip was in the studio, it could be brand newbies across the hall from us and they would come in. So it was just more of like a family feel. We didn't think of like, yo, let's capitalize on Native Tongue. We never treated it like that.
Native Tongues is what, based on Buddy? I mean, the whole concept and the whole idea of this family, you know, dynasty, and it's just Buddy.
Yeah, it's not like... You know? It ain't like EPMD and DOS FX and
Hit Squad and Death Squad. Yeah.
Yeah, you know,
even one better, Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang is the one who maybe took it a step further. You know, they were that dynasty first. You know,
all those groups were like there was groups. Somebody. There was like a leader, and everybody was kind of signed to a one thing. So their agenda was to promote. They're artists. No, none of you guys were signed to each other or anything like that. Just cool with each other.
Just friends, man.
Yeah, just really cool. Just, I mean, it all even came about us being at Africa's house. I walk in, Tip is like, yo, Af, tell Pops what we was talking about earlier. And he was like, yo, we had this idea that whenever we make records, you know, together, opposed to listing all the names, just call ourselves Native Tongue. And I was like, oh, that's dope. I'll go back and tell Dave, you know, Dave and Mason. Tip was like, I'll go back and tell Fife Jarobi and Ali and da-da-da. And he was going to, you know, Africa would tell Sammy B and Mike. And then it just kind of started from there. I know at one point it just kind of got like, all right, but, you know, when Shock G called me one time, we just talking, yeah, man, it's an honor to be a part of Native Tongue. I was like, oh, okay. And I was just thrown off. I was like, what do you mean? And then I find out, like, Africa told him he was in Native Tongue. So I was like.
But, I mean, there was a lot going on behind the scenes as well. I mean. Yeah. There were times where we were doing things and creating things. You know, Native Tongue also had its subsidiaries. Like there was the Fabulous Fleas.
Yeah.
Who was that?
Me, Tip, Africa, and Juju.
Mm. And there was Kids on Zenith Ave. Yeah.
Me, who was that?
Me, Jarobi, and Mike G. And there was another one as well.
Here we go. Here's the one up, Gems.
Yeah. And wait, hold on. Was this more like just a joke? Like was it just kind of like for fun?
Nah, we recorded. I have the.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, what
I
was
got
that?
Some fabulous.
You have that?
I have Fabulous Fleas stuff.
There's music with you, Tip.
Me, Tip, Juju. Africa, and Juju. Yeah. And
Juju from the Beatnuts.
Yeah.
Where are these debts? Where can we go?
Boss has everything. Boss keeps everything.
You live? Don't you live here?
All right, everyone.
We're in Atlanta, right? I think you live in Atlanta, you live in North Carolina, you live in Florida, from what I remember. So we could go over down to Peachtree or whatever that shit's called.
Actually, one of the Fabulous Fleas songs did become a De La record.
Yeah.
Saturdays.
It was originally a Fabulous Fleas record, but then I snatched it back.
You were like, hey, guys, we're going to take the song from your imaginary group and we're going to use it with our real group.
We need this for a real album coming out.
Yeah, right? That's true.
So that Q-Tip verse... originally was recorded for a side group y'all had.
Yeah, we didn't even do the music yet. I just put the music. I'm sorry, we didn't do the lyrics yet. I had put the music together because Tip, I came up with this incredible record for the Fabulous Fleas thing. Africa did too. Juju came up with one. I was like, shit, I got to come up with something. And so I came up with Saturdays. You know.
Fuck.
But yeah, like it was so good. That's one thing that I even talked to Premier about. And, you know, even God Bless the Dead. Dilla, sorry. I was like, yo, I never really considered myself a producer because even when I made records, it's like it was hard to like give it to someone opposed to like, yo, I just made this gem. Let me give it to my group. Like, It's So Easy, I made that for a remix for Naughty. Like, Naughty was working on their album.
Right.
And they had Feel Me Flow.
Yeah.
So, that's Feel Me Flow. Yeah. So, I mean, but it was like.
Yeah, you can't give this away.
You can't give it away. It's like, it's hard to give away.
I don't think we have to pay attention to the Wrap It Up.
That's nice.
I think we're fine. Because there's nothing in this room afterwards.
It's a nice woman doing her job.
Well, I didn't say fuck her. We're doing whatever we want. I just said I think we're okay. Jesus, Sife.
No, we don't want to.
Now.
See, that's crazy. I just want to say one thing. That's crazy because you guys all pitched in on producing all the music, or a lot of it, right?
Yeah.
But you never really did outside production.
Not really.
See, that's where it could have went. Because you, anytime you made something hot, you'd keep it for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Q-Tip and Premier were like, I'm going to give this,
but
give this
that
out.
But that leads to my next thing. I was about to say, the amazing thing about De La is y'all have never broken up. It never really seemed like you were going to break up.
No, close. A couple times.
I'm fine. Close, but everyone's close.
There's been rumors.
No, I mean, to me, the...
Murmurs.
I think I quit twice. But, I mean, that's like, you know, an hour later, you're like, all right.
Is he the likely one to quit, though? You're the one who quit. You're the quitter of the group. You're the one who quit.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Like
I go back to Burger King.
And he was like, "Yo, I will go back to Haiti, and I'm out. I'll be good.
I don't need this shit."
But I was gonna say though, but maybe the not going outside helps the group kind of stay together. Because
it did. It's a big part of it. I think, you know, a lot plays a part of, you know, sticking together, knowing that, you know, number one is De La. You know, we gotta feed it and make sure it's healthy.
Yeah,
and you know, as well as just, you know, the friendship. You're going to get mad. You're going to want to break up. You want to go home, and I can't fuck with these niggas, what have you. But at the end of the day, the magic is here. I always say, like, I you know, I can't get high with nobody else, and the music is the high, you know, and I can't break bread with too many people. So it's like, with these folks right here, I feel good. And I think we all feel the same way.
At what point did you guys realize that this was a permanent thing you were going to be doing, like, because people thought rap was just going to end, like, at some point, right? Like, you know, I read Rakim said that, like, rappers have, like, are like halfbacks in the NFL. Like, you have a 7-year window and it's over. Like, Chris Johnson was great 3 years ago. Now, Chris Johnson can barely pick up 4 yards. No disrespect, Chris Johnson. But at what point did you guys realize, like, oh, we can do this for the rest of our lives and do well with this whole De La Soul thing forever?
Personally, I was always, I guess, I don't know, dreaming. Like, I always felt like we could, because I would always tell them, like, yo, we can do this. Like, never did I ever think any other way about it. Like, to turn around and know that I was in Five Towns College trying to get this music degree was just so my mother could leave me the hell alone. You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, I got to do this Plan B thing. But I always thought, like, yo, this could be forever. Like, you know, Run DMC is going to be forever, or like whoever. Like, I just thought that's all.
I mean, I think we did always say to ourselves, even back then, like, you know, we want to bow out gracefully, you know, when it comes that time where we feel like, all right, we're trying to push something that just isn't working anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We've always agreed and said, you know, we're just going to bow out gracefully and find, you know, other routes to do things. But it's become such a lifestyle that, not purposely, I think we've mastered this to be able to bow out and come back, you know, and I think that's what we've been doing for the last 27 years, and not strategically, not with a plan or anything like that. It's just when it feels good, we're back in there, you know? Mm-hmm. And when we feel like, okay, let other things happen and it's not our time, let's just fall back and just watch and enjoy and learn. You know, I think I love to hear Pa say that all the time. Like, we are still students, you know, 27, 28 years in the game. We learn, and whether it's a Young Thug or Kendrick Lamar, we learn from all of them, you know, and we're going to continue to do that. And hopefully that will continue to give us the energy and the smarts and just the creative ability to keep doing it.
Well, the trials and tribulations let me know it was going to be long term.
What do you mean?
Well, when everything is good, everybody's happy. Mm. It's when things are going bad and you're still trying to figure out how to get it right again. Mm. I think we all came to the unit and still try to figure out how to get it right when things got bad.
Yeah.
When a lot of people came and went in the administration of De La, and when it come down to it at the end of the day, it's just us three. It started with us three. So when, in my world, when I knew it kept coming back to us three, let me know it was going to be forever. Because, mind you, we moved to different states. We moved away from each other. But to do this, we all came back to us. Mm-hmm. Nobody decided to go solo. I didn't go producing a bunch of other people. You know, he didn't go back to Haiti. You know, we really.
We're so glad.
We really came back in the struggle to do this, which let me know this was going to be long term.
So, you know, Syph on this podcast often says, because he's the most honest person I know, that, you know, he's not as trendy as it's become to be that. Syph isn't like the ultimate Dilla head, right? Like, I'm a huge Dilla head. I'm always playing him stuff. But Syph, I think I'm correct in saying that your number one favorite Dilla song of all time that you, like, lose your mind for is Stakes Is High. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely.
So that was, like, the one that really resonated with him. And that record is... you saw the post on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Enough was playing it at the station the other day, and I just like busted in the booth, like, "Yo, you're playing Stakes Is High at noon right now."
Is crazy.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that record. Like, working with Dilla a little bit, and then also it's just a weird, interesting record. The whole way it starts is weird.
There's no form to it. It doesn't have like a typical 8-bar intro. It's just like
that album was the first album where the title was. We understood what it was going to be. I mean, usually beforehand, we worked on music, try to figure out how we're going to gel it together and start figuring out titles. Dave, I want to say, and was it with Fudge as well?
Yeah, Fudge.
Yeah, so I mean, him and his cousin, you know, just in talking, being fathers and just seeing where the world was, we was like, you know, that could be a really great title, Stakes Is High, because even where our career is, even at that point, we weren't sure. Like, after coming out of Balloon Mind State, and as we were saying earlier, Wu-Tang is the biggest shit.
Yeah.
Biggie and everything. Like, where was our footing? Where did we stand?
And did you feel disappointed by Balloon Mind State?
I don't know.
The success of it, yeah. But the project, nah.
Nah, yeah.
It was a good album.
Yeah.
It's one of my least favorites, personally.
Really? And real quick, before we finish the Stakes Is High conversation, when doing Break of Dawn, did you guys ever have to deal with Michael Jackson at all?
I hate Break of Dawn.
He hates Break of Dawn.
You're bugging out. Well, guess what? You're wilding. But do you ever have to deal with Michael? Because everyone said that he was very hands-on as far as clearing records. Like, his team very much had to clear it.
We didn't have a problem. I mean, I think because the original that song, I Can't Help It, it was written by Rod Templeton from Heatwave. So I don't even think it was an issue. Like,
The publishing was lot was through someone else mostly anyway.
Yeah. But there wasn't an issue to clear that at all.
So Michael never called and was like, "Hey, what's good with my song?"
And that was another record that actually I did for someone else, but then the label was like, "We need a radio record," and then I pulled it back.
What, there was going to be another song?
It was originally for one of Prince Paul's artists, Mike Tulux. Mm-hmm. So it was a record.
The Break of Dawn beat was someone else. He told me, you're a notorious stealing beats back.
He steals good shit. And Dave, why don't you like Break It Down?
I did that twice myself.
Everyone, there's a theme in hip hop.
I don't know. Break It Down was, I don't know. Felt like we was kind of chasing what Tommy Boy wanted.
Yeah, they definitely needed. They definitely was looking for that. So I was like, well, why this was
still good though.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I mean, I understand what someone could say about it. I just find it like infectious. It's just, you know, it's a catchy, good fucking song. All right, so Stakes Is High.
Yeah,
it made sense for your life where you guys were at that
so
point.
So, you know, the title, we just needed us to hear that music that would resonate in being the title track. Mm-hmm. So one day I was at Tip's crib, Q-Tip's crib. He's playing a batch of this new JD beats, and it was just, you know, one after the other, dope. It got to the point where a lot of the stuff he did was so dope, like, it was just the norm, so you just listen to it, like, all right, this is dope. So, immediately, when Stakes Is High comes on, because, like, Tip would be like, yo, what do you think of that one, Merce? I'd be like, yeah, that's dope, man. He'd be like, yeah, I think we could, me and Fife, we'll use this one.
He laying to the side, yeah.
So, he plays another one, I'm like, what do you think of this one? I'm like, yo, that's crazy. Yeah, me and Fife. See, the thing about Tip, he's going to be mad when I say this, but when you say it's amazing, then he's like, let me do something with it. But if you say that it ain't dope, then he'll be like, yeah, really? So when I heard Stakes and it came on, immediately I was like,
I need this.
This shit is crazy. He said, yo, what do you think about this one? I was like, eh. I was like, I don't know about this, man. He said, what? I was like, word, because I was like, yo, he's doing the filtering thing, and that's played out. And I on my mother, and I was like, yo, where's your bathroom? I went in the bathroom. I called this motherfucker, and I was like, yo, it's this beat that JD did, and we need this shit. And what? The rest is history. Like, yeah, like, we had to have that record. Like, if I would have said it was dope, there would have been no stakes as high.
And then I'm sure half the songs you said was dope that Tip was like, oh, I'm going to take this, never end up coming out anyway.
Probably yeah, right.
Like, then they're just putting a stack.
Right. So you said, how'd you get the beat?
I called JD. Yeah, yeah. He was more than happy to give it up. Yeah.
Tip, he didn't get mad or anything.
Nah.
He don't even remember. He probably don't even remember. There was so many beats that day.
Yeah.
Did you work with JD on the record, or was it just you took it, rhymed on it?
No, I just took it. I had actually already put my rhyme, half of my rhyme together for another song that we had that we thought could be six, the title track, which was okay.
And did you know you wanted to release the song not only as the title track but as the first single?
We didn't want it to be the first single, actually. We kind of like wanted the attention to be on the business.
Yeah.
Which at first it was.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we wanted a video. We wanted that to be a full-blown like thing. But
I mean, the tradition was always the B-side first in hip-hop.
The business, which for me is famous for its Common's last verse before he became the world knows him and he can't say anything. He has to edit it. I always laugh when he performs it.
That's real.
Yeah.
They got too many white boys. I was what he says, but he says something nicer. Yeah, he says they got too many point guards. But no, the business was a great DJ record because the beginning, the way you brought in the beginning, is such a great record. Mine's mad fuzzy from doing terrible juggles.
Definitely
juggles.
A record you cut up, yeah.
But then, eventually over time, Stakes Is High kind of became.
And as you were saying with the talking up front, that was just during the mastering of the album. We was going back to Tom Coyne. We went to get something to eat, and I think Dave saw this this homeless gentleman sitting out in front of the building, and we just pulled out the tape recorder and start talking to him.
Oh, the fucking
So that wasn't
the homeless guy.
The rambling at the beginning where you can't quite hear what's being said completely.
Well, no, that's a dice game. The rambling inside of the music before I rhyme, that's like Moe's, his brother DCQ, and all them playing dice.
Right.
But
what is
talking,
it say?
The homeless dude talking.
It's like, I don't like rap.
No. He's just talking about down on his luck and.
Oh, yeah.
And then he says, stakes is high. Then the track came on.
So you literally found a homeless guy.
Yeah, we had.
While you were mastering.
Yeah, we was passing him every day during mastering.
Yeah.
And then I was just like, I'll go outside and talk to him. See if he can say, yeah.
I mean, that's.
And now he's Donald Trump.
Yeah, right.
Full circle. That's amazing. And is that one, Stakes Is High, one of the ones you really look back on fondly?
It was an important record. It was a special record. I mean, recording that song, obviously it being a Dilla track, special to us. And just the magic that happened with that record, the way it came together. You know, using the elements again, DCQ, Mos, and I forgot another dude was there as well. And he's like, yo, we need something for the top. I'm like, yo, go play dice. Go play a dice game.
Cash.
Like, yo, play a game in the room real quick. We just record, John. So things just happen naturally and a little crazy with that record. So it's a special record.
What do you think, what's the underrated one that you're like, nah, this one was actually like, for me, I think it's Bionics.
Bionics is top 10, one of my best albums, and I think it's definitely underrated.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great fucking album. Yeah. Do you guys all agree, or is there another one? Maybe it's Grind Date, or maybe it's another one of the AOI
Bionics
series.
I just want to say I worked at Tommy Boy when Bionics came out, and I have boxes of stolen vinyl. If anybody wants them, just let me know.
There's a lot of hands being raised, Saif.
I got the
instrumentals, too?
Instrumental album. Boxes of it.
Attaboy. That's how you're supposed to do it.
I don't know if that came out of your budget. I apologize, but I stole lots of records.
Bionics was a good record. I'd probably have to agree.
Yeah, Bionics. Woo!
What about you, Mace? Is that the underrated one for you?
I think Balloon Mind State was the most underrated.
Yeah.
And you guys seem on the fence about that.
No, I mean, it's the only album that I feel we made that didn't feel complete after it finished. Like, at the end, just to hear that voice at the end, and it just went off the way it did. It just, for me, I didn't feel like it was completed. That's how I feel. I mean,
what happened to Shorty Nomas? She was so cute and awesome. What happened?
She became a mom.
Ah,
I was about to say that. Probably pregnant.
Yeah, a lot of rap careers are changed by the old family thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not somebody we know, too.
I don't know.
I don't know.
No? No? Okay.
Just keep it to yourself, son.
I wonder if that's the thing that came out in the first
the first
podcast. That you're not mentioning it.
I thought it was okay.
Oh, no, that wasn't the thing. You didn't bring up the thing yet.
I don't watch sports.
It's too late. He was an NFL guy.
It is, but.
I think he's a football player, something like that.
Speaking of football players, how is it being the father of a football star?
I'm a proud father. I'm definitely proud to watch my son achieve his dream.
Tell Slife what your son does, because he has no idea or understanding of what football is.
I don't know what's happening right now.
My son is Trey Mason. He plays for the St. Louis Rams. He's a running back for St. Louis Rams.
Is that a... Is that a professional NFL?
So he's on a professional team.
Okay.
He gets paid a shitload of money.
Okay, that's his
and
son.
And he's like a notable player. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Like he's not like a... He has a guaranteed contract. He's
okay, good. So he plays professional sports. Nice. Congrats.
We beat the Redskins got you all a couple weeks ago. I'm sorry. We were at the opposite end of things. But guess what? The check still cleared after the game. Right. So you guys are winning, right. Ultimately. Saif, you don't want to mention the thing that you said? You have to.
Well, it was just how Pasta News came up with his name.
Yeah, so if you would tell us, Pasta, that was on the original podcast, and it's been gone.
But at the time, no one ever knew.
Oh.
Maybe now it's not a big deal.
Yeah, Sop Sound. Funny enough, I wanted that name to be our group name. Like, it was like, it was some battle in the high school. You battled Paul Chisholm and beatboxing. Mm-hmm. And then after did his thing. We all outside with our friends, and I was like, "Yo, we should call the group Sop Sounds." And everybody was like, "Yeah, that sounds whack."
Sop Sounds.
And I was like, "All right, well, let's do it Easy Street." And I was like, "All right." So I was like, "I'll be DJ Sop Sounds," and that Sop Sound was like a thing. Well, my mother would always say, like, "Boy, you better eat everything on your plate. Like, take that bread and sop up the rest of it." So it's like merging stuff together or absorbing. So I thought it would be cool to be DJ Sop Sounds because I would cut all different sounds and music. And so, yeah. But then I turned Sop to Pos Sound to Danoose, and that's how I got Pos Danoose. Yeah. All this without weed either. No weed involved.
But because
that's super nerd right there. That's
yeah, because
Pos
Danoose isn't, it's not that backwards.
Yeah,
it is completely.
Sop is Pos.
Danoose is sound.
But is that, are you making them each backwards separately or all together?
Yeah. Separately.
Yeah, but that's weird. Normally it's like you'd be
it's
just backwards.
De La's weird.
No, like True Goy is yogurt backwards.
Yeah.
We get it.
Yeah.
That is even weirder though. It's a double reverse.
Yeah. Yeah. Reverse. Sounds is
I get it. It's still fucking weird. That's amazing. Were there ever moments in Native Tongues where you guys would, I know everything happened organically, but where you might get, I feel a little left out, like a scenario happens or like one thing happens that's amazing, and you're like, oh, we should have been on that, or it was supposed to go a different way and it didn't.
We thought it was just, really dope that if Jungle was winning with whatever record or Tribe the same way. It's funny enough, like, I hated Scenario. Like, I'm telling Tip, like, I'm like, yo, I don't like this record. Like, my favorite record was Vibes and Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm and
you really have a commercial ear there, boss.
Hey,
Vibes and Stuff is like the most underground song.
I know,
but
I loved it, and I there's so many versions of Scenario because I did two different rhymes for it. There's a version with Mace is on it, rhyme on it, Chris Lighty. So it's different.
Oh, that was in the first podcast too. Yeah.
So okay, so you guys were on Scenario.
Possible.
Yeah, but I told them to take me off. That was ridiculous.
Do you remember
after I heard Busta's verse, I was like, "You crazy?"
And you don't. And you didn't feel any way about you. You have a shit.
I don't know. I hate it.
Now, what about when True Goy ends up on Award Tour?
I was pissed
about
that.
You call Q-Tip and you're like, "Yo, fuck you! Why is it just him?"
No, because it was so dope. And I remember was that the same album when he did the joint with Large P on it?
Yep, same album.
Yeah, I want the rhyme on that. And Tim was like, nah. So I was like, fuck you, I'm going to get you back. So when we did Lovely How I Let My Mind Float, and we was in the studio with Biz, Tip was like, yo, let me get on that. I said, nah, man, it got enough people on it.
Yeah. How was the award tour situation cool, Dave? Like,
no, that was cool. We was all just sitting in actually, Tip was down the hall recording in Battery Studio. We was on the other end. And he came in the room and was like, yo, I need a chorus. Well, let me hear it. And went down the hall, and we actually sat down in, like, maybe 5 minutes and wrote it together.
The rhymes were there already?
Rhymes were
just
there.
A beat.
No rhymes.
Just a beat.
Just a beat.
So he wanted a...
You just wanted something.
So do you write the chorus?
Yeah.
And you have writer's credit for the chorus?
No, we're
friends. That didn't start until Mace, like the other Mace and Betha came in. You charge friends. You don't... We
that
didn't charge friend? No.
So no publishing for that.
Yeah, not charge him for upfront fee, but you wrote on the song.
Yeah, but
so, I mean
we did that. We did that like that was the vibe.
Yeah.
The vibe was just like help each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would help you later on in life to collect a check.
Help you buy another house because a war tour becomes a huge hit.
And you know what's crazy, honestly? It would happen that way to this day.
Same thing.
Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Yo, what the fuck? And speaking of which, what the fuck was Shiffy MCs, that record? Like, where'd that come from?
Shiffy MCs.
Yeah. Shocking Shiffy females.
MCs. Yeah, but like, what was the record for? Like, you have that, you know that record?
No.
Anyone know that record?
It's a Clear Auditorium.
It's on Clear Lake Auditorium.
Oh, is that JJ? Yeah, no, JJ knows it. Nerd Rap. Yeah, we have like DJs all got it. It was all bootleg. Right. Like, but yeah, what was it? Was a De La Tribe record, of which there aren't that many.
Yeah.
No.
You know, so it's kind of an interesting song in that sense. So what happened with that?
It's another day.
Yeah. Just a song you guys did, and it didn't have a place, so it ended up just
floating. Yeah, just floating.
Just floating, and we threw it on that little
EP.
Thing.
Clear Lake Auditorium.
It was like a spinoff of Balloon Monster.
Yeah.
Oh, the Clear Lake Auditorium?
Yeah. It was on
amazing.
There.
I got some of those, too. Vinyl.
Sife, I'm not kidding. I need one of those.
Okay.
The clear vinyl?
Yeah. I have the clear green vinyl and the CD.
I ain't in front. I need two.
That shit. Yo, he's looking at you so.
I got some shit, yo.
Hold on, because there's another. There's two weird records from. Okay, there's Clear Lake Auditorium, but then after the next album.
Like orange vinyl?
Yeah, there's the Super Sweet Sticks also.
Oh, that's the one I have.
Fuck.
Oh, that's the orange vinyl.
Yeah.
That's the one I have, not the. Yeah. Maybe I have.
And that has other random shit on it. Like
I think like an extended MC version of Baby or something like that.
What's It's Hot or It's So Hot? Is that
that's the remix to It's So Easy?
Right.
Is that on there as well?
I don't know.
Okay, so what's
Sweet Dreams is on there?
Sweet Dreams.
Yeah, there's a lot of De La bonus records like that. If you're not like a DJ nerd, so you might want to go looking around the internet. They probably all exist somewhere.
Yeah.
Ripped on some like Norwegian website where you
pretty much.
And you have to figure out how to download.
Won't find it on iTunes.
So what's the plan? What's next for De La? Are you guys gearing up to do one of these times when it feels like coming together or what?
I mean, this album that we're releasing is just about done. We have a new album coming out 2016 entitled Anonymous Nobody.
That's right.
We did a Kickstarter for that. What was that? March, April? Around that time?
Yeah.
April?
Yeah.
Raised just over $600,000 to record the record.
Wow.
Like you guys. They really like.
Oh, that was amazing.
How does that feel like?
That was.
I didn't know about it. I would have contributed.
That was amazing, man. That was like.
Give him something now.
You said, I don't have Wi-Fi.
I don't want to attribute it to people just really liking us. There's a lot of work that went into that. You know, here it is. People like us, like they like Kane and like they like Special Ed, but it's the work I think we put in the last 3 years for that Kickstarter to be as successful as it was.
Yeah, I agree.
Does that include the thing you guys did with your music when you did that really interesting thing when it was like your music hadn't been available previously?
Yeah.
And you sent that email. It was one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen. Yeah. Was that all part of the same movement, or is that a separate piece?
This is an organic thing, somebody coming up with a great idea, putting it out there, giving it a shot, and not being afraid to invest in what we feel and what we come up with the help of friends and people who care about us, and just shooting it, you know, just giving it a shot. Even the Kickstarter is basically us networking with people and getting some ideas of how to do things, and then just feeling, you know, brave enough to give it a shot.
Yeah.
And as successful as the free album release, you know, that was a great setup for the Kickstarter.
And in addition to the Dilla mixtape.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That was for
Which
donations.
Was another random one. Like, you know, we was like, oh, let's do something. We had went to Dilla Day, and we saw Fife perform his song that he did, and was like, yo, man, let's try something. Let's give it a shot. And also this album, just conceptually giving an idea a chance. We had been performing with a band called the Rhythm Roots All-Stars out of L.A. for several years, over maybe like 8 years or so, and we just came up with an idea to record with a live band. But opposed to just recording with a live band, which has been done so many times before, we went in and recorded with these guys over 2.5 years, just jam sessions. We just like let them play whatever, with a little bit of guidance and direction from us saying, you know, stay there, try this bass line, what have you. They just jammed for over about 250 hours. And then we took another year to go back and listen to those jam sessions and sample from that.
Wow.
So, you know, that's the concept of this record, where we basically are sampling ourselves. Mm. And just coming out with, you know, new tunes. We're probably 95% of the way into the album.
Still got to get like a homeless guy.
Yeah, we got to find a homeless dude. Well, we got some interesting people on the album.
Yeah, it's interesting.
People that we really respect and, you know, took the time to suss out. 2 Chainz is on the record.
Wow.
Yeah. Rock Marciano's on the record.
Ooh, okay.
Who else?
David Byrne of Talking Heads is on the record.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Damon Albarn.
Damon Albarn of Gorillaz and Blur is on the record.
We got a record with Usher.
Usher's on
it's dope. Album. It's Got you know, it's easy to do stuff, you know, like, yo, let's do a record with Common and Q-Tip. But we just figure like, yo, let's push.
Snoop's on the album.
Yeah, Snoop's on the album. Yeah.
That's
me. It's a dope album.
And we have and 2016, is that the closest time frame we're going to get? We know anything else?
Yeah, nah. I mean, we in the midst of the whole Kickstarter campaign, we suggested that we would get it done by September. But honestly, it'd be rushing it if we put it out, and we want to do it right. So we're hoping. I'll throw a date. I'll throw a month. Probably like March. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll have the album. So we're all working on it and trying to complete it.
Well, yeah, it's almost finished, so it's definitely coming. Yeah.
By the way, just because I feel like we haven't mentioned it, we should just say just at least mention it. Ooh was a fucking amazing random.
There's a version of Ooh with Corrupt on it.
Yeah, but Corrupt.
That's another thing from the last podcast.
Yeah, because the remix is supposed to have Corrupt and Redman rhyming. Yeah.
So that exists. That is somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the Corrupt version, yeah.
Why Red don't Man you put that stuff out?
Yeah, what about all the shit
time,
you have?
My brother in town.
Yeah, shit out, man. Please.
Well, you know, that was a time for Corrupt with what was going on with Death Row.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, you got to get clearance for people like that.
Right? Yeah. Of course, that would be
in time. Though we got a lot of stuff that we want to release.
We got tons of shit.
Yo, listen, we're just so happy that, you know, not things happen. Nothing's guaranteed in life, and as we get older, you know, groups don't work out, things fall apart, people change. People, I mean, let's keep it real. Sometimes they just lose it. They're just never quite the same anymore.
That's
and
right.
They try to make it, and you're always kind of like, you feel bad for them. You're like, oh, this isn't it. I love that you guys are a group that we always just get to admire and never feel bad for.
Oh, thank you,
like
man.
All we do is admire you and be like, wow, this is amazing. So make some noise for De La Soul, everyone.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Thank you guys for doing this
yet again.
Man.
Word. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Thank y'all.
Did it record?
Press save.
I'm going to go. No, I'm doing it myself. I'm going back to myself to go save press that. Save.
Press save.
Guys, thank you. Thank you guys all. Thank you guys for coming out.
Appreciate it.
3:30, Rock Him.
Why you got to play that?